Landau's Fermi liquid theory, which is a kind of a phenomenological theory for treating Fermi liquids. It's also, in some ways, quite fundamental, and in the sort of perspective that it gives on Fermi liquids. And I would say the whole area of Fermi liquids and non-Fermi liquids is, or if you like, the stability of the Fermi liquid, which I'm going to argue in a minute, is a subject which is active current research. So I've listed the references here. Actually, these are the references that I wrote down last year when I did a very, very cursory treatment of Fermi liquid theory. This year, to be honest, I've used Pierce's book to guide me through how to present the subject. And this book, which isn't really a book, it's basically available in preprint form from Pierce Coleman's website, and it's still a work in progress. For instance, the references aren't filled in, and there's probably some sections haven't been written. But the chapter on Fermi liquid theory is actually in reasonably good shape. And I found it, for me, it was just at the right level for a course like this. So I would encourage you to look at it. I'm going to follow it rather closely. There are some other useful references. Actually, Tony Leggett's classic paper in Reviews of Modern Physics on the theory of the superfluid phases of helium-3, I mean, being another Fermi liquid. the normal phase of helium-3 at low temperatures, where it's degenerate but not yet condensed into a superfluid, is an excellent illustration of the ideas of Landau's Fermi liquid theory. There's this very nice book on quantum many-body theory and condensed matter physics. I'm not sure, that's probably not exactly the title, but we have it in our library out there, by Bruce and Flensburg, which is actually a generally useful text if you're interested in the many-body theory and the field theory of condensed matter physics. Wen's book discusses Fermi liquid theory. And then there's the original paper by Landau, which you won't, I guess, easily find online, but I went to the McMaster Library and copied it, and we put it up on the wiki. So you can, I mean, there's nothing like reading Landau's own words about this subject. Now, I should go on and say that there's a whole literature developing the microscopic basis for this theory in the Russian literature, and I think if you wade through, I'm not suggesting you do this, but if you ever really want to see all of that, you wade through the book by Abrakosov, Gorkov, and Zaloshinsky, which is a classic Russian text on many-body theory and condensed matter physics. And there are I'm pretty sure there. Actually, even the second volume of the Landau and Lifshitz series on statistical mechanics, that has an elaborate treatment of Landau Fermi liquid theory. So there are quite a number of references. But so the way that Pierce Coleman introduces the subject is with the idea of adiabaticity. And the question is simply the following. What happens if you have a box of electrons or fermions, if it's actually charged fermions, then with their neutralizing, with an equal number of neutralizing positive charges? What happens if you have a box of non-interacting fermions, so then in that case, no charge, and you gradually turn on the interactions? The idea is, so that's what adiabaticity is, the effect of slowly turning on electron-electron interactions. So for instance, you have a Hamiltonian, which is the non-interacting Hamiltonian, and then there are the electron-electron interactions, and the question is, what happens when you turn them on? And the picture that I have in my mind is that you have a fixed number of electrons. Okay, and to start out with, then, you know that the all of the kinetic energy states in momentum space are filled up in such a way that all of the lowest states are filled and the ones above them are empty. Once it, you know, you fill up just enough states to consume all your electrons. And then, so that's for the non-interacting case. And the question is, what happens then if you just slowly turn on interactions? And one way of looking at this is, to what extent does it make sense to think of this as a system in which the ground state wave function is equivalent to having filled up all the low-lying states in momentum space? Now, the states will still be labeled by momenta. You haven't done anything to affect conservation of momentum. Certainly, turning on these interactions between the electrons, momentum is still a good quantum number, although not necessarily, well, yeah, okay. So one way of looking at this is to imagine that in the absence of interactions, you have these levels. So these are the energy levels of your many-body system. Now, not to be confused with the one-electron energy levels that we often talk about. So these are the states, so this is E versus lambda. And the question is, as you turn on lambda, what happens? Well, this state will probably go down. In fact, it will go down in energy. This state might start to go down, but if these states if these states have the same type of symmetry, they'll repel each other. Similarly, this guy might have gone up. And so the idea is that in general, these energy levels won't cross. They'll repel each other as you turn on the interactions. And there will be one state at the bottom, which will be your ground state, which will be adiabatically connected to the non-interacting state. Okay? So that's true to the extent that it's true. It's not the only thing that can happen. Okay? So let me actually, why don't I finish the argument, Peter, and then because the two things go hand in hand. So this, if you like, is one scenario of what could happen to these energy levels as you turn on the interactions. Another possibility is that this thing could go along and something else could cross it. And these states can cross if they have different symmetry. So the interaction doesn't change the symmetry. The interaction itself doesn't change the symmetry of this system. So if you look at the matrix elements between two states of different symmetry, then with a symmetric Hamiltonian in the middle, those matrix elements will vanish. Okay. So this you could call a phase transition. So those are two possibilities of what can happen. And in this case, you would say that, well, once you've turned on the interactions, you're really dealing with a different system. It has a different symmetry. Its ground state wave function would have to be described in some rather different way. Okay. But in this case here, you could say, well, it's a different wave function, but it has evolved continuously from this wave function that looks like a non-interacting Fermi liquid. Okay, Peter, did you want to? So let's see. So in the hydrogen atom, you have a 1s and a 2s and 2p orbitals and so forth. Okay? So I guess the question would be if you... Well, it's not a very good example, unfortunately, because it's only one electron. You're already solving the interaction with the nucleus.
But it is a good example in the sense that the p orbital can cross the s orbital, and they don't mix with each other.
In the two state, yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, that's a good example of that. But the question is, okay, but still, you don't have electron-electron interactions. So it's electron-nucleon interaction, and there's effects that make them false. That's true.
I just want to ask, by symmetry, do you mean like any type of symmetry?
Probably, but I was thinking, I guess, of spatial or in spin space type symmetry, for instance. This interaction is symmetrical on your rotating all of your spins. And this ground state here is also symmetrical. You can imagine if you have a transition to ferromagnetism, okay, then that would be a different symmetry state where the spins pick out a direction. Okay, so that would be a different, that would be an instability, if you like, which is an instability, in fact. Okay. I mean, a classic instability is superconductivity. Okay, and in fact, you can probably make good arguments that if you have a Fermi liquid that at low enough temperature it should, you know, it would often, more often than not, have an instability to a superconducting state. Now you might say, yeah, but superconductors require some kind of effective attractive interactions. Okay, but on the other hand, we've seen in high temperature superconductivity or in the theories related to it that even with repulsive interactions you can get superconductivity. But in any case, that would be an instability to a different symmetry state. Yeah, change. Lambda is just a parameter you can change by hand. So it's something which connects zero this to that, this plus that.
So what do you mean when you have a phase transition?
As there's a value of lambda below which your ground state looks like psi naught, and above which it looks like psi 1. And this is a big quantum many body system, so that's a kind of phase transition. Yeah?
Basically, actually do this, like something that would be analogous to tweaking the value of lambda, like, for example, change the temperature of some specific system, like above some temperature or below some temperature, the electron-electron interactions would be negligible, and then they would become important.
In principle, yeah, that's not maybe the closest analog to what we're doing here, because here we're talking about ground state wave functions which try to minimize the energy, and what you're talking about is a thermal system which is trying to minimize its free energy. But for sure, you can vary the temperature. An example of tuning the parameters would be, say, in these cold atomic gases, where they can actually tune the two-particle interaction between atoms in these hyperfine states in such a way that, you know, it can change. They can go through a resonance. I forget what they call this. Feshbach resonances, yeah, so they can actually change the scattering length that goes up to infinity and comes back down. And anyway, Michael, we can
another example is in high temperature superconducting materials. Typically, those things have really complicated formulae. And what you do is by changing the amount of doping of some impurity in the compound, you effectively change the electron-electron interaction, and you can stabilize different kinds of ground states.
Yeah, although a lot of that is changing the doping, I guess, when you change the chemistry, which changes the density of whatever it is.
But effectively, you're changing. Yeah. You have a parameter, and you change that.
Right. You're right. I guess in a large range, actually, another reason why that's a good example is because there is a regime of doping in which high temperature superconductors seem to be like Fermi liquids. Act somewhat like normal metals, and another range of doping where they seem to be not like Fermi liquids. And who else here?
This is that you pick up slowly turning on. What does it
mean? Yeah. It's just me. It's sort of a loose analogy here. I mean, the idea is that. If you're thinking of turning interactions on and off, okay, you're implying that you're doing something that's a function of time. You're not so interested in any of the effects that would result from the speed at which you did it. Okay, so for instance, you know, if you were changing the interaction at some high frequency, you would get some, first of all, you wouldn't have stationary states and so forth. So adiabaticity is referring to the situation where you change the parameter slowly enough so that the only thing that matters is its value and not how fast you're changing it. That's really the idea here. But people use this term. They say that this state is adiabatically connected to this state. What they mean is that even if you've changed the parameter very, that you've changed the parameter very slowly and nothing drastic has happened. Whereas, and that only makes sense in the context of this example, where you could have equally well changed the parameter slowly, but for sure something would happen here when these two levels cross. Okay, so that's the context in which people talk about adiabaticity. Yes?
There's something called, if you superheat the fluid, then it doesn't boil above its boiling point. Can that have to do with if you very slowly change the temperature to above the boiling point, then it finally
I think that that's more, so that's like you're thinking of the phenomenon of hysteresis, or superheating in that case, I guess. Yeah, that's, that, yeah. That's a much more complicated, well, I don't know where I should say that. Superheating is where you, well, I guess supercooling is, yeah. It's well, also where you cool it down and it doesn't condense, or you heat it up, it doesn't, yeah. And then you disturb it a little bit and all of a sudden that,
yes.
I think that's perhaps a more complicated subject because the idea here is that, in a sense, it's sort of like the opposite, because here, the idea is that if you change slowly, it will flip over. Whereas if you were superheating or supercooling, you change the parameter, you would go past the crossing point. And that has to do with kinetic paths. In other words, okay, how is it going to get from this symmetry state to this symmetry state? Maybe there's some free energy barriers that prevent it from getting into a lower free energy state. Okay, so by talking about superheating or supercooling, you've introduced one extra level of complexity, which is how does it get from here, to here? Can it do that in a continuous way so that it will follow exactly this path? Or are there other complications in making that transition? Okay, so so the idea then is that the wave function in this case should, you should be able to write it in a rather similar way all the way across this box. So the idea is that psi naught, which is the, the structure of this is that this means the ground state, the lowest one. In the non-interacting case, you can characterize this ground state wave function in terms of the occupation of different momentum states or different states in k-space. And so the idea of this adiabaticity, or this adiabatic evolution of the wave function, is that this evolves into a different wave function, but of the same type. And again, I'm visualizing this for fixed n, total number of electrons. So here, these ends are all 0 or 1. They're 0 within the Fermi momentum, within the Fermi sphere. And at this point, I should say that we're assuming a uniform isotropic liquid. Things become more complicated when you have to put in band structure, crystal lattice effects. And we're probably not going to do that. And the point is that, so this wave function is characterized by these occupation numbers, which are 0 or 1 for different momenta. And the idea is that this one too. Okay, so the point is that the structure of your wave function is that for this isotropic Fermi liquid, is that in the non-interacting case, you have occupation one for states with momentum inside the Fermi sphere in momentum space, and zero outside. And that this wave function, whatever it is, has that same property. Now, at this point, you might say, what's the difference? Well, actually, let me just say what's the same. Okay, so we want to, come back to the question, okay, what's the difference between these wave functions? But let's first start by continuing on this line of saying what's the same about them. The states labeled by P and sigma, so that's, we've already said something, we've made this big statement, are this wave function is going to be describable in terms of occupation numbers of single particle states labeled by momentum and spin. So it's the same P. These states have associated with them the same charge. If you remove, if you change an occupation from 1 to 0, you reduce the charge by one electron charge. And the same spin, when you remove that, when you change that occupation number, you're removing a particle with spin half. I already said it's the same PF. Why is it the same Fermi wave vector? Does anybody want to comment on that? Michael? It's the same, this is just a magnitude of PF. Okay. The idea is that it's the same number of momenta, of electrons, same number of electrons. Okay? No, that's by hypothesis. In our box, we keep the same number of electrons. Yeah, it comes in the spatial variation of the wave function that describes these states. They're still waves. Okay, it's quantum mechanics. And so these states are labeled by a wave vector, which is the spatial dependence of that one particle state will be E to the I P dot R over H bar. Okay? And the same rule applies that the density of momentum states in momentum space is 1 per unit of momentum. Okay? And that's why when you construct a state by occupying n's up to pf, you get exactly the same number of electrons by conjecture that you start with. Yes, the density of states changes. The density of states changes everywhere. Okay. So what changes is epsilon of p and sigma, or equivalently, some m star, if you can characterize the energy-momentum relation for these quasi-particles by an effective mass. Okay? And hence, say the density of states at the Fermi energy will change due to interactions. The effective mass. So it's if you can describe the relationship for single particles between energy and momentum as h bar or p squared over 2m star, say. M star would be the electron mass when lambda equals 0. It will be something else when lambda equals 1. Yeah, Peter. Say that again?
What is n star of 0?
That's the density of states at the Fermi energy of the highest occupant. This is the density of states of all the states that have p equals pf. How many of them? Fermi body. Okay, so the idea is that your wave function is still describable in this way, and that the only thing that's really changed is the single particle energy that you use to describe it. None of this is very important until you start creating excitations, because really what's happened is you crank up lambda and your energy's gone down for the whole many-body system. And the fact that things like m star, the effective mass, and the density of states and so forth doesn't really matter until you start to disturb the system and say, okay, what happens if we start from this state and we create the lowest lying excitations of the system, which are different, which change it from its ground state configuration. How do those excitations behave? And those are the things that are sensitive to these quantities, which are essentially the same quantity. Okay? So let's just say, did I miss something here? Another way of saying this is what changes is the velocity at which the whatever these particles are that are labeled by these n's move at. Okay, so what we mean, one of the things that we mean, probably most of what we mean, by saying that this state has the same character as this state is best described in terms of what are the excitations of a state like this. Okay, the excitations of a state like this, well, there's one kind or two kinds of excitations where you add an electron with momentum p and spin sigma, where or you remove let's call this p prime. So these are called charged excitations. I've mentioned this before. And these both cost a positive energy measured with respect to the chemical potential, to the chemical potential that the system has in the presence of the interactions. Where this is actually P or P prime for, you know, above or below the Fermi energy. They both cost a positive energy. And then there are the so-called neutral excitations. Which are an electron hole pair. Where this is an electron and this is called a hole. Yeah. Yeah, well, okay, so the question that we originally asked is what happens if we've got n electrons and in their ground state in the presence of interactions? And then the next question is what kind of changes can you make to the system? Okay? And the kind of change that you're talking about, which keeps Ne the same, which is to remove a particle from a state below the Fermi, below PF, and put it above, is a neutral excitation. And that can be decomposed into saying, well, what happens if I take an extra electron, put it in, and then take one of the electrons that's already there inside the Fermi sphere and take it out? Okay, so you can decompose the neutral excitation into two charged excitations. Yeah?
So what are the excited wave functions that we originally started with? What kind of excitations do they
were? They were exactly of the same type. Okay, so we had the same type. In the non-interacting Fermi gas, the ground state is lowest magnitude of momentum states filled, everything else empty, and the low-lying excited states were these. And I think I remember commenting at the time that that's very special to fermionic systems near their ground state. They have a fermionic excitation spectrum, which is put together by adding particles above PF and removing them from below PF. You can then, by doing that systematically, enumerate all of the low-lying excited states. Okay? And then multiples, combinations of those, and so forth. Okay? And that's distinctive. That's, if you think about the ground state of the Bose system, well, that's a little complicated, I guess. But it's different. Okay. It's totally different. You don't have this nice Fermi sphere. right? Everything's gone into the zero momentum state. Michael.
I love this question out of hand, but I'm really interested to ask.
Yep.
If you take a real mirror, mm-hmm. one that you think would have strongly interacting electrons, and you hit it with an X-ray, mm-hmm. and you pop an electron out, mm-hmm. so that would measure the excitation spectrum for creating holes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Does that really have a theta function at a definite energy that you interpret as the thermal energy?
Does the system to start with?
No.
Before you did that?
This experiment.
Does this experiment? Yeah.
Measure some probability of changing the system to add or subtract a certain amount of momentum, which would be momentum of that electron. And when you really do the experiment, is there a theta function at the Fermi surface?
Okay. So. Yeah, I was just looking to the end to see how many aspects of Fermi liquid theory are actually treated in these notes, and I didn't do that, which probably makes it a legitimate question, because I wasn't planning to say it. Yeah. So the question is, So... the answer is that the effects of the interactions actually change the distribution function around the Fermi energy. However, to the extent that you're in a situation like this, where it's still a Fermi liquid, then what you find is that instead of having a Fermi function that looks like that, it gets rounded off but there's still this sort of discontinuity, okay? And to a certain extent you can say this is another way of telling whether it's a Fermi liquid or not, because when this thing goes away, then it actually isn't like a Fermi liquid anymore. Okay. Interestingly enough, in a superconductor, the superconducting wave function, in the ground state wave function of a superconductor, you can also calculate what is the expectation value in the ground state of the occupation of the original free particle states. And that function actually also looks like a Fermi function, but it's completely rounded off. Okay, so when you condense into a superconducting state, you sort of destroy this discontinuity in the distribution function. Yeah.
At zero temperature.
Oh yeah. We're talking about zero temperature. That's right.
But like, we are never really at zero temperature.
I know, but you know, you can get very close. Particularly keeping in mind that the characteristic energy scale here is related to the density of states at the Fermi energy, which is 1/1 an electronic energy. Okay, so so the point is you can actually make your temperature low enough so that it's you can guess what happens if you have then made it zero for metals.
Particularly, as you said, in this room. Particularly in this room.
In this. Why? You think it's cold? Okay, so that's the idea. The idea is that if in the presence of interactions you still have a Fermi liquid, then its excitation spectra looks like the spectrum of a non-interacting Fermi liquid, except that maybe you've changed the density of states, or the effect of mass, or the relationship between the momentum and the velocity of a particle. Having said that, You haven't changed the charge of an excitation, and you haven't changed the spin of the excitation. Okay, they're still, in that sense, fermionic quasiparticles. They're called quasiparticles. But they're charge E, spin half, quasiparticles. Yep.
So one would expect that somehow the interaction parameters related to the charge.
And as you as you change the interaction parameter.
You mean as you turn on the
right.
The Coulomb interaction? I mean, you know, one way of thinking of the charge is just the way of counting particles. Okay, one way. Another way is to say, okay, what is its relationship to, I don't know what, sort of thing.
Okay.
Right. But certainly, turning on the Coulomb interaction is a possibility here, which we're not going to discuss very much. And keep in mind that in a metal, when you turn on the Coulomb interaction between the electrons, you have to simultaneously turn on the Coulomb interaction with the ions in such a way that the system always remains, on average, neutral. Okay, and it's actually useful to think about what are the charge, what happens if the electrons maybe are a little bit compressed over here, so you've got some extra electrons. That pretty well means that someplace else you're missing some electrons. So there's a negative region here and a positive region there. You can imagine a density wave in the electrons. If you have a density wave in the electrons, so at the peaks it's negative, but in between it's positive in such a way that the total charge is zero. Because the Coulomb force is very strong, right, for our condensed matter, it's very strong. Okay, so now let's go on. I still haven't made a complete argument about whether this picture makes sense, because I haven't really said anything about, so say I take an extra electron and put it into the system, and I put it at some momentum which is larger than PF, and some energy which is larger than the highest energy of the occupied state. So I put it in there, and I say, okay, so the question is to what extent is that state an eigenstate of the system? To what extent does it have a well-defined energy? Normally, you think of your ground state and your excited states as having sharp energies. And the question is, if I take an extra electron and put it in, just have it sit there at that momentum and energy, is that a sharply defined state of the system, or is that the other possibility would be that there's some really complicated superposition of states like that that are the eigenstates of the system, so that if you like, I can prepare the system in that state, but it might decay immediately. Okay? Into some combination of eigenstates of the system. So the question is this state a well-defined, sharply defined state? And the answer is, which I guess I'm going to, well, I'll argue. That's one way of asking the question. Another way of asking it is, how quickly do they decay? because there may be, if I put in, if I do this, there may be ways that that electron can decay, as I'll show you a picture of, into some lower-lying excitations or some other excitations. So the answer is, we'll call the decay rate, which is related to the inverse of the lifetime of such a state. This goes, the answer is, that this goes like epsilon squared, where epsilon is the energy above the Fermi energy that you've put it in at. And without, before trying to argue why this is true, I'll just discuss what it means. What it means is that adding an electron like this, whose energy is very close to the Fermi energy, gives you a sharply defined state. And adding an electron way above the Fermi energy, you get a state which is not well defined. Okay, like if you added a 2EF, it'll have a width that's 2EF. I don't know, something like that. Or no, excuse me, worse. Actually, it's probably hard to say. This is for small deviations from the Fermi energy. So the idea here got this filled Fermi C, and I've put an electron up here where this is epsilon in energy above the Fermi energy. And so the question is, how long does it stay like that? Or how long is it before see if I've got this right. So you can have a process that I've indicated schematically here, where this fellow decays to some lower energy, some different momentum, and you excite an electron from down here up here in such a way that the sum of the energies that the excitation energy and so forth is equal to epsilon. Okay? Hope I've drawn this right. And so if that kind of process can happen, so diagrammatically the interactions, I suppose you could draw it like this. This is a electron-like state decaying into two electrons in a hole. And it can be resonant. If this guy is up at finite energy, that can happen resonantly. And there's probably a lot of other things that can happen, too. And so this electron state here will have some finite lifetime. However, you can sort of see that that the energy is less than epsilon. And this guy here that you've removed must have been within epsilon of the Fermi energy too. Okay, so in order for this process to be resonant, the final state of this guy must be within epsilon of the Fermi energy, and the hole which is excited must be within epsilon of the Fermi energy. And hence, this epsilon squared. Okay, so that's the argument, that the phase space, if you like, for the resonant processes by which this guy can decay go like epsilon squared because of Fermi statistics and the fact that we have a filled Fermi C. Yep.
So what's the second state, is that stable?
No. None of these things. Lots of, there's still more things that can happen. Okay, but the point is that this is more stable. These are more stable. Individually, they're more stable because they're closer to the Fermi energy. And so there's fewer things that can happen to them. Okay? But they all basically obey this rule, that the lifetime of that state goes like epsilon squared, where epsilon is the distance to the Fermi energy. Okay? So that's basically the argument, that the lifetime, the one electron lifetime, goes like epsilon squared. Now, you might say, epsilon squared, how do you normalize this? I mean, it's probably epsilon squared times the density of states at the Fermi energy to give you the right units. Okay. And the density of states at the Fermi energy goes inversely with the Fermi energy. So that's 1 over a large energy. And that's an even additional argument as to why this decay rate is small, that the characteristic energy scale that this thing gets normalized with is the Fermi energy, 1 over the Fermi energy. Okay. Actually, it's probably more complicated than that because the interaction has to come in somehow. Okay. But basically, the phase space tells you that states close to the Fermi energy, excitations close to the Fermi energy, are sharply defined. And as you move away, their decay rate increases like epsilon squared. And in fact, a more complete calculation, if you then try to do a microscopic calculation of the lifetime or decay rate of this excitation, you do it at finite temperatures, you pick up a T squared. Okay, so it's basically epsilon squared plus T squared. And I won't work that out. Now, okay, so if you guys are comfortable with that or just equilibrating with that, let's go on. What happens if you have two charges, two electrons above the Fermi energy? They'll interact with each other. Okay, so So here again, the phase space for scattering is constrained. So for instance, if you draw the Fermi sphere here, and you say that you created two quasiparticles, you've added two quasi-electrons at the Fermi energy, to say right above the Fermi energy here and here. And they have a total momentum . So the question is, how can they scatter? Well, they have to conserve momentum, so they have to conserve momentum. And energetically, they pretty much have to end up on the Fermi surface because the collision conserves energy too. Okay? I mean, if you tried to scatter this one into a state which was out here, you'd have to scatter this one into a state that was in here, but it can't go there because those states are all filled. Okay? So the nature of this state is such that basically, these things can scatter only very weakly. Actually, I think you should do this yourself for the one-dimensional case, where the states between minus PF and plus PF are filled, and you add two electrons anywhere, and see what your phase space is for them scattering into different states. You find that it's highly constrained. Here, actually, in two dimensions, it's pretty well constrained to what you would call scattering into itself. You can make small adjustments having to do with how close this thing is to the Fermi energy and how close this thing is to the Fermi energy. There's a small number of states that you could scatter into. In three dimensions, it's a little bit different because actually they can scatter into any state on a circle that conserves the total momentum and the total energy. So this is like a circle that goes behind the Fermi sphere, which corresponds to they can sort of stay opposite to each other anywhere along the circle. But nevertheless, it's clear that this, because of the fact that all of these states inside the Fermi surface are filled, that really limits your phase space for what these two quasi-electrons can scatter into. Now, this is discussed, if you look in Pierce's book, this is discussed in a number of different ways and in a number of different places. And the first time that he mentions it, he doesn't say exactly what I say here. I mean, what he says would maybe work, apply in two dimensions. But later on, if you go towards the end of the chapter, you get the same story. I mean, so the question that the people are concerned about is, as you have a finite density of quasi-electrons, to what extent do their interactions destabilize or make this not less like a Fermi liquid? And the answer is that if they're all close to the Fermi energy, it doesn't drastically change the nature of the state. It's not that it doesn't change the nature of the state, and actually, oh, where's that nice picture Michael made me draw? I'll draw it again. The interactions do change the state. They just don't cause a phase transition. They don't change it into something totally different. Okay, so these are basically Landau's observation that the very severe restrictions on the phase space for particle decay and scattering are what stabilizes a state of this type. Okay, in other words, or explain why it makes sense to say that this wave function has this form. Okay, so how are we doing? Are we late? We're late. Yeah, okay, so I guess we have to stop. Yeah. Okay, yeah, Felix.
Is there any possible change allowed to switch P1 to P2 with each other?
It sort of depends on how, yeah, you mean just interchanging them, like exchange, yeah, you can always have the exchange.
Is that the only uncertainty?
Well, no, that's not the only uncertainty, because I've drawn them exactly at the Fermi energy, but if you look at this thing in a fine scale, their excitations, after all, they're not exactly at the Fermi energy. So they can distribute, I'm pretty sure they can do something to draw yourself some pictures.
Okay.
Because, yeah.
So when you talk about these quasi particles, you talk about the energy line like within some sort of range around the Fermi energy that mm-hmm. you decided to consider.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, and like, what is that sort of layer that you, like you said? Okay.
I just said, suppose you put one in at some energy epsilon, which is close to the Fermi energy. Then the phase space for it to decay, to excite a hole in a particle and decay into another state, is limited by the magnitude of its energy, epsilon. And it's limited like epsilon squared. So epsilon can be anything, but the argument makes most sense if epsilon is small compared to EF. Okay, so we'll start there.